Welcome to our guests. Thank you. Monday night is when we've been meeting to discuss the Dharma Flower Sutra, sometimes called the Wonderful Dharma Lotus Flower Sutra, full name, sometimes just Lotus Sutra. Important part's the flower part. As Mahayana practitioners, we traditionally visualize that we're not just sitting on a kapok or other kind of cushion, but a lotus flower. Some people maybe have read Beware of Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Walking Meditation, where it talks about when you walk, you should imagine like lotus flower emerges to take your step, right? When the Buddha was born, apparently he's quite precocious and was able to take a step immediately. And lotus flowers came up to meet his feet. It's very nice if people don't stomp around, right? And watch people walk and see if they kind of imagine they're placing their feet on a lotus flower when they're walking. It's a much more gentle way to treat the earth, don't you think? So we visualize the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as emerging from lotus. Many of the lotus flowers that we see in America are actually, you know, one of maybe, I don't know, 500 different species of lotuses. The ones I'm familiar with from India are quite big. So you can really can imagine yourself, you know, sitting in the center on the kind of pistil of the lotus with the petals around you. So in Mahayana practice, we walk, particularly walking meditation, which we do doing every Sunday, Doug? Every Sunday? Yeah, Patty, yeah. Very important meditation practice, and then when we sit, we're sitting on lotus. If we are peaceful, we imagine we're sitting on a moon cushion. If we're doing fierce practice, we're imagining we're sitting on a sun cushion. Maybe that's a little too esoteric, but in any case, you're sitting on a very comfortable cushion. Lotus flower. When I ask people in darshan, when we're just doing the refuge, Namo, Gurubye, and so forth that we did in English, I said, do you visualize yourself sitting on lotus flower and having that lineage tree present and all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas smiling and sending white light to your forehead, Om, red to your throat and blue to your heart? I ask people that. Most of the time they say, oh, I forgot. Okay. So, I'm reminding you. And like that Dirk said, okay, narrative meditation, right? I like that, you know, because when you say prayer, a lot of times people go, oh, I, you know, that's churchy. I don't want to do prayer. So we're not, what are we praying to anyway? I thought Buddhism is non-theistic, blah, blah. So we call them narrative meditation sometimes, but it's still okay to say prayers. But when we do the prayers, the narrative meditations, we want to be sitting, like we have, like, Shakyamuni, he's sitting on his lotus. You need to find your own lotus. So when we're doing shamatha meditation, that includes mindfulness meditation. Traditionally, people are visualizing Shakyamuni Buddha on lotus flower. So when you're doing, for many years, you have to practice. So you have a shrine, and the table, the shrine table or shrine something, as you're sitting in front of it, maybe if you have a big enough space, maybe 6 feet, 5 feet away, and you have a nice picture of, or statue of Shakyamuni, and you're actually looking at it, right? So you're doing shamatha based on with sight. Because when you're doing meditation, you want to start first with stability. The mind becomes what it pays attention to. That's really important. So you actually have your eyes open and you're looking at your altar. It has maybe offering bowls or other pictures, but fundamentally has a main picture or statue, and it's not moving, so you're looking at it and you're gazing very softly. You're sitting on your cushion that you're imagining is a lotus, right? So it's very gentle gazing. It's easy in India when it's kind of twilight, either in the morning and evening, to sit by like lotus. And the eye, you know, you can have your eyes open and you can easily gaze without strain. So I know we have electric lights here. They're LED, so we're politically correct. But it's a little hard when it's this bright, you know. So when you're in your home, you don't need it killer bright. You know, a gentle light, enough to see the form, but not so much that you're kind of like, you know. So you're starting the practice by, when you know, by having a stable object in front of you. You're sitting in a stable way. Maybe it could be a chair. You could be sitting in a chair in front of your shrine. At least you're sitting somewhere and you're looking at something that's stable, right? Maybe it's the floor, okay, I don't know. Maybe you're inclined towards Soto Zen practice and you... That's very sweet, yeah. That's very stable, hopefully. Yeah, emotionally stability too, like you don't have with Shakyamuni, or if you have close connection with your lama, your guru, then you don't have lots of doubts, right? So when you don't have lots of doubts, then it's very easy to do shamatha on your teacher, of course. When people have doubts, then I will say, you know, visualize Dalai Lama, or a lineage teacher that you have no doubts about, or visualize Shakyamuni like that. If you have further doubts, then you'll have to just look at the wall. But okay, the idea is stable attention, right? This is different than how Theravada, Vipassana, or mindfulness meditations taught in the West, isn't it? Because generally, in the West, people are taught, like, just pay attention to changing thoughts and experience, right? And then let go. Just notice, let go, notice, let go. This is actually quite difficult. It's portrayed as being easy, but it's difficult. So I've made some modifications that, okay, if you really want to pay attention to something that changes because you're stuck on the fact that maybe impermanence is all there is, then please pay attention to your breath rhythm. In any case, it's important to breathe fully and evenly, right? So we don't create panic by gasping for breath, panting. But it's still a little bit more difficult to establish stable mind on breath because breath is constantly changing, isn't it? Unless you really, really can find the balance point of the breath and stable rhythm in the breath. So for some people, say, well, you know, develop meditation based on looking at Shakyamuni or me or looking at flower that doesn't move. And also when that's tiring, pay attention to your breath rhythm, follow your breath. That makes sense, right? Not so hard. You should have at least confidence that you're breathing, right? You don't know, like, I don't know what I'm visualizing, but we should know we're breathing. So sometimes, even though the breath is changing, we sometimes have less doubt, right? But when things are constantly changing and we have doubt, like, I don't know if I'm doing it, I don't know what I'm paying attention to, then it's going to be really difficult to attain stable, focused meditation. So we're actually not doing any form of meditation. We're kind of watching and doubting, right? When you're watching and doubting too much, I mean, we inevitably kind of watch and doubt on some level. But if we're training to watching and doubt, we're saying, well, this is the point. I'm supposed to watch and doubt. Then that will be your result. You'll be a watcher and a doubter, which could keep you out of trouble, right? If you're an impulsive kind of person, you're very dramatic, then you can say, well, I'm watching from the sidelines. I'm not in the drama, whether it's a relationship drama or health drama or family drama. And I'm questioning myself, is this smart? And so that's better maybe than actually being impulsive and getting involved too much in the drama. But we're just training to kind of watching from a distance, and we're doubting what we're seeing and happening. But I know for many people in the West that maybe that's better than their out of control lifestyle, right? Oh, okay. But with training to that instead of training to stability and non-doubt, it will be very difficult to develop deeper forms of insight or deeper forms of openness or stability, because we'll just stop right there. So I invite you to find a stable object of meditation, if possible, from the beginning. But if not, then alternate between breath and visualization. Visualization can be outside, like you actually have your eyes open, you're looking at a statue or photo or painting. Or if you have the inclination and some more concentration power, then we can concentrate just on a mental image. So I'm not talking about seeing a holographic vision in front of you. I'm actually, you know, saying you can see in your mind's eye. It's not that hard with something we're familiar with. It's very easy for me to see, for example, my kitchen at home. I can just see it immediately. Can you all see your kitchen at home? I can see exactly where the, you know, coffee thing is, and you know exactly where the dishes are in the sink and everything. So I could hold that visualization for quite a long time because I'm familiar with it. I can probably also hold a visualization for quite a long time of like Golden Gate Bridge, which I'm fond of talking about. So I don't have to go see and watch the Golden Gate Bridge. I don't have to put a picture of the Golden Gate Bridge, just like I don't have to see my kitchen or have a photo of the kitchen in front of me. It's so familiar. The minute I say, you know, kitchen, there it is, right? In full color. So it's not like I'm seeing it as a hologram in front of me. Isn't that amazing? I know all of you can do that. So when people say, I can't visualize, all we need to do is think of something we're very, very familiar with. And then you can do it. So when you become familiar, of course, with looking at a flower or a Buddha statue, picture of your teacher, then it becomes very, very familiar, and then it's easy. However, we're training toward the ability to have before the mind both just mind image and visual sense, or even hearing sense or tasting or touching, the ability to hold an unfamiliar object to the mind, right? Because that's training for real life, isn't it? Real life is not always familiar. If we're unable to hold an unfamiliar phenomenon in front of the mind, then what are we going to do? We're going to either panic or we're going to fixate on it or something, right? We can't just hold it when it stays. We're with it. When it moves, we let it move and go on to something else. So ultimately, we're training to real life. But generally, in our tradition, we want to first train to stability and then train to change. This is totally different than schools of Dharma that, which are not Asian, by the way. They're American. Because everything in Asia starts with shamatha. Okay. But I understand people need to move. So that's why I'd rather see people, instead of trying to always pay attention to moving inside, maybe like walking too, right? Because then you really are moving. It's functional moving. You're not just running after moving, right? Functional. It's really good. The flower, then, the idealized lotus, is an important part of the visualization because it's, it's where the Buddhas arise from, the Bodhisattvas arise out of lotus. And it's also like non-human. We're emotionally attached to humans. even the Buddha were emotionally attached, but the lotus, like the other like flowers around, are kind of like neutral in a way. They're a little non-human. So it's important to, you know, pay attention to those two. So we always have, always when you're visualizing the Buddha, you're not just cutting him off here, you're also getting the lotus throne, right? The lotus seat. I'm really hammering away at this tonight. But since every once in a while in Darshan people don't get it, so and then everyone has to pay the price. Okay. He's gonna lecture on Shamatha again. Yeah. We need to train to stability first because stability implies safety. It implies home. It implies security, you know. So we're training first to, you know, things don't change first. It's more difficult to accommodate change ultimately than things are the same. So that's why we want to start you out with shamatha practice, how to abide in a calm way. If you decide you can't work anymore and you want to get on Social Security disability, which some people do because of an injury or an emotional trauma, I know how to do it because I worked as a workers' comp counselor exclusively for 10 years and then still do some workers' comp work. Why has everybody that's asked me to help them get on Social Security disability been successful? What one thing is absolutely necessary to work? What one thing must you have in order to be employed and to work? Stability, yes. You must have concentration. You must have it. I know this because I've done the work so much. Also, I know because back way before I knew any of you, like when I was doing workers' comp counseling, actually dated somebody who worked as a Social Security analyst. I said, what's the one thing that, you know, if they don't have, they won't get it, and if they do have, they will get it? It's concentration. If you can't pay attention and concentrate, you are dangerous. You can't do the job, right? Your mind's all over the place, can't concentrate. Social Security doesn't care if you're depressed. They don't care if you're anxious. Because we're all depressed and anxious, come on, right? But if you can't concentrate, you're dangerous. If you can't concentrate, you can't even do higher functioning such as good judgment or making decisions because you can't remember. If you can't concentrate, you can't remember. You're toast. My concentration level is a lot higher than most people. That's why I can accomplish so much. It's not because I'm a better person. Maybe I have some bodhicitta too, but I don't lose concentration the way many people do. Longer concentration, deeper concentration. Concentration by itself is not insight or liberation. But with low concentration, you can get insight, but the concentration is like the container. The insight's like the water, the concentration's like the cup. So you might say, I don't want to develop my concentration very much because I read so-and-so saying it's all about vipassana, it's not about shamatha, and I want vipassana. And well, then you'll have a little thimble full of water, you'll have a thimble full of insight because you haven't developed a very, very big bowl. You haven't developed, you know, a sink or a bathtub. You haven't developed a swimming pool. That's the concentration. It's not just the emotional, like, I love everybody, so my bodhicitta is huge, so I can develop, you know, big power. No, it comes from the shamatha, it comes from samadhi, it comes from mental stability. That's why we need to do retreats, and thank goodness we have places we can do retreats like Lotus View and so forth, or here. You can have insight without doing a lot of concentration. It's true. But you'll have to keep refilling it because you'll just have a teacup. Your practice will be like putting, like when we were broke in high school, you know, we'd like put like, you know, a quarter of a gallon in the tank, right? Yeah. Did anybody ever run out of gas in high school? Yeah. Like, so, you know, you never had enough money to fill up the tank. You didn't even know how much the tank held. You know, it's like, you got a dollar? Okay, let's go. You know, those days, right? But I learned a lot. That's where I got my basic metaphor of rolling to a stop. People have heard that. Like, I know people that grew up in the country. I wasn't really in the country. We were just kind of on the edge. Like, you steal, you borrow your dad's or mom's car, and you take it out and you drive it out into the eastern Colorado, and you run out of gas. Yeah. And then you feel that, you hear the gravel under. That's important too. We want to roll to a stop. Concentration has this really incredible, like, once you come to a stop, you've really stopped. It isn't putting on the brakes. What's the third noble truth? We have scholars here. What is the truth of what? Correct. Many people skip over that. Okay, cessation. The end of suffering. You really want to have that experience. People think, what good is concentration? Well, yeah, I can do more stuff, but, you know. No, because then you really experience what stopping is. And you don't restart. Oh, this is stop. We need that experience. You need to have that. And until Buddhahood, maybe we're going to start up again. You know, oh my God, I'll need to start up. But you have that experience of, like, in that moment, the concentration and insight allows you to just stop. Without doing the shamatha, you won't stop. You'll go, yeah, I saw the purity, natural purity, pristine purity of mind, but yeah, I'm still going. You know, like that, someone's bipolar. Yeah, yep. Saw a little Dzogchen, kept going. It was great. I'll catch you next time. Catch you next retreat and around. You know, I'm like, no, you want to roll to stop, and then you just stay there. Concentration means the mind isn't moving. It's not just that, you know, you put your concentration there and go, okay, enough of that. And, you know, no, you just stop. Real shamatha is you don't want to be anywhere else. It's not like, well, I've stopped. It's not putting on the brakes, which is a different experience, right? We go to a stopping sign, put on brakes. No, you really, like, rolled, you've stopped. So you're not grinding, going, okay, when do I get going again? Stopped. Nirodha, cessation. So we need to develop the shamatha practice, which is boring, which is repetitive. but then you fall in love with maintenance. So we have time for a few questions, comments, or complaints, and then we'll do some shamatha, perhaps. Like that. Oh, you'll bite. Yeah, no, we need, yeah, this is good. Thank you. Dana has trained us well. So it's good to know.
Okay, so when, like in, when let's say the Ganges Mahamudra, one of those first few passages, when you're looking at the space, let's say, because that metaphor is used a number of times, and watch and thoughts self-liberate. That's not shamatha. Is that what you're saying? Or is that, I mean, that's, I'm trying to make the distinction between shamatha and that, resting in the nature of mind.
In Mahamudra and Dzogchen, shamatha and vipassana have united.
So Trailer
they're united.
Yes, Trailer Rinpoche says you start with tranquility meditation,
yes,
and then you do the four.
Yes.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's progressive.
Okay.
But in fruition, they're united.
So you don't start there, even if you, let's say that you're working on the Ganges Mahamudra, you need to start instead with 10 or 15 minutes.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's why, this is kind of technical, students asking, but yeah, it's very important that we realize, even though we're reading these fruition pith instructions, like Fly to the Garuda or Ganges Mahamudra Talopa, yeah, we still have to, we have to get on the on-ramp and build up speed before you get on the freeway. Yeah, it's going to be gradual. You're going to start with four thoughts that turn the mind. You're going to start with Brahma Viharas. You're going to start with shamatha, yes, and progressive levels, like in Mahamudra, the four yogas and so forth.
You don't want to get through at 35.
No. That's right. Yeah, so when we're reading these fruition texts, most of them are from the standpoint of this is just the way it is. Shamatha and Vipassana have been united, so they're not talking so much about path. It's more fruition like that. Yeah. Hello. Oh, yes, we need. Yes, here we go. Yes, good.
My question is about you start your meditation with shamatha, and then many times you'll also do analytic meditation. And say, for example, if you're in the foundations course, look at this, deconstruct this, or whatever. And then the thought is to incorporate that and go back to rest in that in shamatha is what I'm presuming. And sometimes that's a really hard transition to go from that where you have a quiet mind and then you go to whatever the concept is and think about it, deconstruct it, or whatever the point of the exercise is, and then you kind of rest in whatever the conclusion is. And sometimes my mind just keeps going.
Yes.
How do you slow it down?
Well, the sadhanas and our practice are set up for like real life. So, yeah, generally, if we have time to do training, during the day, then our path is going to be We're going to do the shamatha meditation and then some vipassana meditation, some yoga meditation, and then having to rest in that. So we're alternating between these different meditative states because that's real life. A lot of times when we initially sit, we might say, okay, is that for, let's say, is that for 18 minutes? And think, oh, I'm really, really calm. But then, you know, we do an analytical meditation and then we notice, oh, well, that really stirred up a lot of dust. So there's no reason for being discouraged, you know, because that's the practice. We, you know, just go back over it again. It's like when we turn on the light, you see the dust. So, you really just want to... There are, of course, ways to cut through discursive thought and spinning and things like that, but if possible, you just want to reapply the shamatha antidotes, or you can just say, I'm just going to sit here until I stop spinning, because you will. At some point, if we don't move the body, the mind will land. If we have enough time, you know, because we'll spend, usually we think, I've got to get going, so I got to get back to concentration, and then, because I got to get to work or something. But, yeah. So that's why we need retreat time, because you do some shamatha practice and you do some narrative practices or visualization, and it kind of gets us in a little bit of excitement. And then we want to go back to, you know, resting. Shamatha really is just resting in whatever, right? Doesn't have to be, you know, Shakyamuni or lotus flower. You can do shamatha on nature mind, which is close to Mahamudra, but not quite the same. You know, and then you see, okay, well, that's where the dust is. This is what I have to work on. So we actually should be happy, like, oh, that's great. But I know that we have to leave enough time, so then we settle down and center again. Yes, yeah, that's good advice, yeah. Yeah, like, yeah.
That was all off the mic.
Yeah. Off the record, but good. Well, we'll remember. Yeah. Yeah. So there are two things always when we're training. We're doing basically an intervention, saying concentrate on this, analyze this, see this, and then we're noticing what happens as the result. Those two must go together. You know, sometimes I get annoyed. Of course, some people go, they're just on the technique, which would be just like sharpening the knife, okay? We'd say, am I sharpening the knife just right? And I go, yeah. You know, okay, great, you sharpen the knife. Okay, feel sharp. But then people put it back in. But what you're supposed to do is take the sharp knife and then, you know, start working on the tomato and then see what happens, right? But so many people are like, they're just going after the technique. The technique is to develop a concentrated awareness, right? Just like sharp, okay, something like that. But then, you know, then people get disturbed when they see like this happens as a result. But that's feedback, right? We want to get feedback on our practice. So you're getting feedback, so that's good news. You're paying attention to the feedback. But most people don't want feedback. Well, I got a sharp knife, don't bother me, I put it back in, you know, it's cabinet, you know, and you go. So you want to then, you know, slice your tomato, right? I know Roberta likes tomatoes a little. They're really good. I haven't gotten any recently, but it's a pitch. So then Yeah, thank you. So then you want to taste the tomato. See, many times Dharma people, they do the technique, they apply the technique. Okay, we're cutting the tomato, but then they don't taste it, right? So we want to live the life, right? You don't want a semi-dull knife with a hard Raley's tomato. That is no fun. Right. So, but then you want to taste the tomato. So that's the fruition. The fruition is not like I've sharpened the knife. The fruition is not like, well, now I cut the tomato and then put it back in the fridge. No, you want to taste it. In California, people like food metaphors. I've noticed it does a lot better. Okay. You don't need to take a break. We can just sit, right? But one last question, comment, or complaint? Okay, hi. You're a guest, so you get to say something.
I'm new, but I try to do the meditation on my own.
Yes.
It's very hard to concentrate. My mind will wander around.
Yes.
And even when I go to sleep, I've been feeling this for... my father passed away about 2 months. And since he passed away, I don't know, it's been so disturbing that all night long I'm running around in the dreams. So the way I sleep, the way I wake up, and very hard to concentrate on things. So I'm just trying to figure out what's the best way to... go behind that, but you know, I can concentrate more and meditate better, or find that center of the brain where I can find peace of mind.
Getting some support, you know, for concentration is not cheating. So, you know, and particularly in our school, we can find interesting and stable, pleasurable objects to concentrate on. Right? Usually, we're after unstable objects. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So usually, like, I'm after chocolate, but then I eat it and then it's gone. That's an unstable concentration, right? But sometimes, like, nice music, or, you know, water flowing, you know, or a nice, even nice smell like incense, right? So you're using the senses to help you concentrate. So for some people, they really are very visual, and they'll just look at a painting or statue. Other people... They want steady sound, right? Or a steady, you know, smell like that.
And what about when you're sleeping? Like, you know, your mind is wandering in 20 different directions, and it feels like you get more tired when you wake up in the morning rather than feeling relaxed.
Yeah. It's hard with grieving, you know, because of course it really stirs up impermanence, you know, like the antithesis to stability, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, doing, and this is a longer discussion, but, you know, really their sleep ritual is important. Creating a very, like, this is what I'm going to dream about. This is what I'm going to sleep. These are the experiences I'm going to have. So you actually program your sleep. That's important. We just don't want to, usually people go, I'm going to sleep. Whatever I dream, I'm going to dream, right? I don't think that way. Why think that way? That's silly, right? You know, people go, I mean, from a high Dzogchen level, you can say, whatever happens, great. But honestly, so I don't go to sleep thinking, oh, whatever I dream about, I'm going to dream about. No, I'd be dreaming about, like, Managed Health Network and billing. I don't want to dream about that, right? So I'm going to program, you know, this is what I want to dream about tonight. Why not? We think about the day, we should be thinking about, well, what do we want to think about or imagine during the day? So sleep's the same. Don't just kind of like, just, you know, kind of, oh, well, I don't know, something will happen, right? So it's easier to go, this is what I'd like to dream about. These are the visualizations. Do a little pre-meditation, like, I'd like to take this journey. I'd like to see this person, you know, and make sure it's stable and peaceful, right? Then you're more likely, you know, you're creating a direction for your mind stream.
You
know, yeah, this is useful. Good question. Yeah, blessings for your father. So, but let's do. We'll sit here quietly and you'll do whatever you do. So, very good. Those who left, welcome back. For those who stayed present, thanks for staying. So if we have time, you know, during the day to do our training, like 24 minutes, you could do 6 minutes of, foundation practice, the narrative meditations. And 18 minutes of shamatha, something like that. That would be helpful. It's always important to do some kind of emotional foundation, right? That's what the higher training in ethics is, you know. That's the foundation, you know, creating right motivation and non-harming, right? You know, don't harm, help. Okay, that's higher training in ethics. Then the second part is higher training in samadhi, concentration. And then the third part is higher training in wisdom, right? Those are the three higher trainings. So, I'm a little edgy today, so I'm going to say most of the time, sanghas and get in trouble, teachers get in trouble, particularly when they're just saying, I'm just going to teach the higher training in wisdom, right? And the concentration and the motivation ethics will just kind of come out of that. Then we have trouble. You always have the foundation and the motivation, the non-harming and the helping. That's the ethics, the precepts, you know, like that. Frankly, if I'm all pissed off and I'm not doing... You know, I'm just kind of lying or screwing around. I don't know how you can develop any calm or concentration, right? Because you're just stirred up all inside, you know? Even if you think, I'll just pay attention to my breath and forget about, you know, that problem. You know, it's easier to have a simple life. Could be complicated, but simple if you're not harming others and you're helping. Then you develop the concentration, the shamatha practice, which is difficult because we're all stirred up, and then do the wisdom. So at Lion's Roar, we're very innovative. I like doing innovative things. Everyone is open, it's available, but I'm just saying everyone can do not harming and helping. Everyone can do some kind of stability, concentration meditation, and then do the insight or wisdom, right? So we're completely open, but we're just saying everyone can do this, right? I'm very positive about human nature. I'm not cynical like some teachers go, well, I just, you know, they won't be able to do any non-harming or helping activities. They won't be able to do any shamatha, so I better just teach wisdom teachings and then they'll find that fascinating and stick around and give me a lot of money. That's not what we do here, right? We don't do that, do we, Patty? No. So we're doing very classically, so... You know you're getting good foundation, right? And then we don't have to mess up. It's like a duh, but, right? That makes sense, right? Guests, right? Lead ethical, helpful life. It's not like Boy Scout, Girl Scouts. It's you're trying your best, right? And then you develop, then it's easy. Then you develop the concentration, and then the wisdom comes. That's simple. It's hard to do, I know. I started out the other way. I'm I started out that way. I started out like, I just want the wisdom teachings, and I don't want to hear about concentration or ethics. You know, I'm an old hippie and stoner, so I just wanted it, you know, I want the experience fast, and don't tell me what to do, and then, you know, I'll get it. That didn't work. Okay. So that's why we have good, wonderful Sangha here, because we're doing completely classically, but innovative, right? No. If you think you can do Mahamudra Dzogchen practice and not do the ethics and the concentration, then that's when the teacher will say, I'll meet you in Avicii. And that's not a place in Italy. Okay, so we should do prayers. Thank you, Jose. Actions to attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and go, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are a source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. The teachings of the Buddha flourish. May the upholders of the teachings remain forever. May all learners achieve happiness. May all their temporary and ultimate goals. Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of objects, compassion. Manjushri, master of flawless wisdom. Vajrapani, destroyer of the entire host of Maras. Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the snowy land sages. Losang Drakpa, I make request at your holy feet. So one thing I didn't mention earlier is that in our tradition, we always dedicate the benefit of our practice to others, to share, right? It doesn't mean like we're giving it all away and then we're bereft, right? It means we're just sharing it, right? You don't have to say, okay, I don't have any, I'm giving away, I'm sacrificing all my spiritual energy for you. This is not a sacrifice model. It's called a friendship sharing model. So you can have your cake and eat it too. You can say, I have my cake and I'll give you some pieces and I get to have a piece too, right? That's good, right? You know, you're not sacrificing at all. Okay, so we dedicate the merit. This Sunday, I'll be here at 10 o'clock to help with a service for Jan. So everyone is invited to do that. We'll probably do like 45-minute service and then there'll be the regular Sunday service at 11, like that. Yes. Newman, yeah. Yes, it is. Thank you. Yeah, thank you, everyone. It's been really nice. It's just great. It's the best. Yeah. See you soon.